Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
Now, look, I'm not sure how reliable the data is, but a report out a couple of days ago said more of us want a veggie patch than we do a barbecue. Now, if you've managed to get one going in your place, and that's the veggie patch, not the barbecue, you'll know the joy of harvesting the fresh food, sharing it with your neighbours when there's a bit of a surplus, and if you're really on top of it, maybe bottling some of it for the off-season. As the world becomes an increasingly confusing place to be, the simple tasks of just digging around in the dirt, watching things grow, it's probably one of the best ways to disconnect from those small screens, get away from the phone, and connect with something bigger. Now, the name permaculture was a joining together of permanent and culture. And if you were half awake in the 70s, you might have thought it was a bit subversive, kind of hippie thing perhaps. But it's turned out that those principles of permaculture are at the very heart of what we now call sustainable living. These guys were onto it really early.
People do not make this kind of noise at 6 o'clock in the morning in Surbiton.
I'd agree with you if it wasn't necessary, but it is. It's Mother Nature, isn't it? At this time of year, she says, dig my earth, she says, plant my crops, she says. It's no good having a go at me, take it up with her.
You remember that show, don't you? The Good Life, Tom and Barbara Good, those wholesome mainstream dropouts living next door to posh Margot and Jerry. But you don't have to go all out and sort of live off the grid to bring permaculture to your backyard. You're going to hear from people who are proof of that, and I'm very excited to say that you're also going to hear from one of permaculture's founding fathers today.
I'm gonna plant a tree, then plant another 3,000. Now's the time to start feeding my soul.
Let's hear from three people who embrace permaculture. Jody Lane lives with four generations of her family on land at the beautiful Margaret River, and her story starts on the forest blockades in WA to save those beautiful old-growth forests in the 90s. Charlie McGee describes himself as a hyperactive Muppet, and he's the frontman for the formidable Vegetable Sound System. We'll find out what that's all about shortly. And David Holmgren, well, you probably know that name because, as I promised, he's one of permaculture's founding fathers. So we're going to start with David. Run us through, David, what are the basic tenets of permaculture?
Well, that's a big question.
Give me the top three. Give me the top three.
Well, of course, permaculture as a design system for sustainable living and land use is grounded firstly in three ethics of care for the earth, care for people, and fair share. So that makes it different from just a set of techniques or strategies in that it's always guided by that ethical framework. And we don't see those as having been unique to permaculture. They're more the distillation of what was common of all sustainable traditional cultures around the world had some version of that framework. And of course, we've perhaps lost a bit of connection to that. And then the way we apply that, of course, is much more diverse and varied from place to place and context to context.
How much of permaculture is about challenging that paradigm of work more, earn more, spend more, consume, consume, consume?
Oh, well, that's definitely a big part of it. I see there's two broad frameworks. So when I said it's a design system for sustainable living and land use, mm-hmm. that means it's concerned with both the consumption side of the equation, how we live and organise ourselves and our behaviours, and the other side is the production side of the equation, how we, through agriculture and gardening and the other ways that we get our basic and essential needs from a working relationship with nature, whether we do that directly or whether it's being done on our behalf through the economic system. So permaculture is focused on both of those, and so we sort of can think of that as one part is, if you like, voluntary simplicity. How can we downsize? How can we simplify? How can we work out how not to do things that aren't really necessary or really even beneficial? And the other is, how can we ramp up a sustainable productivity from that working relationship with nature? So it's working on both those ends of the spectrum.
What are some of the myths about permaculture and how it came about, David?
I think in the 1970s, permaculture was so associated with mulching that many people thought permaculture was mulching. Now, of course, mulching is part of normal horticultural practice almost everywhere, but certainly permaculture was at the forefront of promoting sustainable techniques and methods of not just gardening, but also how we could change and reform broadacre agriculture to make it more sustainable. And then through that base of starting with food first, all of the other ways that we get our needs, housing, water supply, energy, all of those things. But permaculture started with food. It's not confined to food. And a lot of people thought permaculture was, well, a cool form of organic gardening, or maybe a sort of back to the land self-sufficiency. So those were some of the expressions of permaculture in the beginning, but it was always a whole system redesign. And it spread out in the world after the publication of Permaculture One in 1978. And that book was by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. But I was only 23 when that book was published, and Bill Mollison was in his 40s and sort of ready for a larger stage than the University of Tasmania, where he had been a lecturer. A lot of people assumed he was my supervising academic, but I was actually at a different institution, and I never went to one of his lectures in the psychology faculty, but we worked together creating the permaculture concept, and if you like, the first permaculture garden on the foot slopes of Mount Wellington, just outside Hobart.
And now these days, organic produce and sustainable living, you know, they're becoming more and more mainstream. How do these ideas fit within the framework, I suppose, of permaculture?
Well, as I said about mulching, a lot of radical ideas at the conceptual level and right down at the practical nitty-gritty level have been promoted and experimented with through permaculture design, teaching and practice around Australia and around the world. But as those things become adopted into society, inevitably they get changed and morphed around the other design rules of society. So, for example, organic produce, organic farming really started with very much local food for local people, but it sort of ended up a little bit in the globalised production system for the global elite, or at least that's one sort of aspect of organics today. So we can see how as radical ideas are adopted, they are also sort of morphed back to fit into the box of the way society currently does things. Whereas permaculture is always constantly challenging that framework and saying, no, the way we're doing that is basically still unsustainable.
David, is permaculture a return perhaps to something that was known centuries ago?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting, if you like, criticism or critique that often comes from especially older people and people maybe more embedded in rural self-reliance or traditional cultures. And they say, isn't a lot of permaculture just common sense? And I'd say, yeah, well, that's true, except it's no longer common.
I was going to say that, but well done. You got it out first.
Yeah, but there are aspects of ecological design and understandings that have emerged in the world quite recently, which can, if you like, using that terrible term, add value to those that traditional wisdom. And so there's elements of permaculture in especially the design process, and also the fact that a lot of traditional cultures had a limited suite of plants and domestic animals with which they could design sustainable systems. Whereas in the modern world, we have access to so many more plants and animals, that palette of design possibilities is so much greater. And of course, the problems to do with sustainability of water limits, of climate limits, a lot of those are novel problems that people in the past didn't have to face, as well as the opportunities to creatively use technologies that have already been invented and created to help us on that path to what we see as a sort of a more prosperous way down from the over-complex way that society does things at the moment, which, of course, are killing the planet and will kill humanity if we don't make fundamental changes. So they're big issues, but they're also things that people can address in their own lives directly.
You know, if you're a bit over that concrete jungle, how do you adopt the principles of permaculture in your life, David? What are some of the simple things we can do?
Well, a lot of it involves an audit of the household situation, because the household is the basic unit of economic organisation in society that people often take for granted. And mostly our households are often too small to really be sustainable, too few people living together, and a lot of people's lives are taken away each day from where they live through commuting, through commitments, through debt. So this constant daily migration, often long distances and at substantial cost to themselves and the environment, how can we sort of relocalise back to spending more time at home? And thinking about that, not at an individual level, but at that collective level of whether it's a family or whether it's a shared house, looking at that whole situation, looking at how much debt is driving what we do, how much addictive behaviours are driving what we do. So working out how to free up time and focus on skill development that builds that resilience. And different people will be motivated by different things. Some of it is a concern about living a lower ecological footprint. Other is no, to escape the madness of modern life and live a more sensible way. And for other people, it's the motivation of building resilience against the shocks and changes that are already built into our future. And I think probably the biggest motivation is people thinking about when they've got children, especially very young children, and you mentioned screens and getting out in the garden as an alternative to that media interaction. So I think it's different starting points for different people, and there's certainly not a single formula for that. But my retro suburbia book, The Downshifter's Guide to a Resilient Future, is a manual for actually doing that, that's been built on now four decades of permaculture practice around this country and, in fact, around the world, but very much focused on where the majority of Australians live in some sort of version of what we would call suburbia. And there's huge potential in those sort of places still to be more self-reliant. And I think, you know, some of the people that have connected in of are examples in, yeah. Yeah, of this huge growth in interest in what I call garden agriculture, because permaculture is of course a bigger framework than that, but we see that garden agriculture producing fresh fruit and veggies and small livestock products at home in the household and community non-monetary economy is still one of the most important agendas for sustainability from a permaculture perspective.
So given what's going on in the world at the moment, you know, political instability, climate change, a deep disconnection and a bit of a distrust with politicians, and, you know, we just talked about the screen factor, how much of a renaissance is permaculture experiencing, if you can use that term?
Huge. It's actually gone in waves in my lifetime, and it's been, the waves have come when the economy is either shaky or people's trust in institutions and government is at a low ebb. And then there's sort of long periods of consolidation when people are feeling more comfortable about the way society is. So there was a big wave in the 70s that permaculture took off in the late 70s. I see date the end of that wave as being about 83. And then there was a second wave in the late 80s, early 90s. There was a third wave that sort of really was probably stillborn by the events of September the 11th, sort of the whole environmental agenda was shunted sideways mm-hmm. by the war on terror. But then after the GFC, all of the interest in these things came back very strongly. And it's had little bits and ups and downs since then, but it's been on a growth path that has been building stronger and stronger. And some of that is just permaculture, but that's nested in a wider interest in what we can broadly call sustainable bottom-up solutions that are coming from people's just own responses and, as I said, partly distrust in centralised systems and, you know, whether that's the banks or government or the supermarkets
or the media even.
Yes, you know.
Unfortunately.
And, yeah, and, you know, so that means there's, of course, at times like this in society, there's a thousand voices talking. It's a bit like, you know, a Tower of Babel, a whole lot of different voices of that people can't necessarily understand each other. But a big theme in that is a greater interest in doing more things for ourselves and taking more responsibility, because we can see both the ethical need for that and the pragmatic need to how to do things ourselves. So, you know, like repair cafes, the interest in fixing things, in making things from scratch, it's all part of that same story.
So you do describe permaculture, I suppose, as a form of activism?
Absolutely, because, and this is, you know, I suppose in permaculture activism over the decades, sometimes people have said, oh, permaculture actually is revolution disguised as gardening. And, you know, to some extent that's true because, you know, a lot of the things that need to change are really big, but we can do a lot of those things through simple things that most people in society would say, well, what's the harm in that? You know, what's the harm in people gardening? That's all good. Well, actually, for the large supermarket chains, a loss of market share of a few percent has the shareholders really worried. You know, so, you know, there are things that are, you know, very clearly when people choose to do things in their own interest, there are other established interests that stand to lose. And so in that sense, those things are radical activism. And we see a lot of those things are much more benign forms of activism than, if you like, a ramp up to, you know, how do we stop the, you know, climate catastrophe? There's ways we can address this that are at least complementary to the oppositional environmentalism that, you know, gets a lot more media play and focus.
So, David Holgram, is there a sense of urgency now, though, in this because of where we're at?
Oh, you betcha. There's a lot of people, you know, a lot of it gets characterised as preppers, you know, preparing for Armageddon and, you know, isn't it the boy who cried wolf that, you know, there's been people saying this for a long time and, but the point about the parable of the boy who cried wolf is that the wolf eventually did come. You know, so the evidence of the problems society's facing and that will precipitate, you know, serious problems in some form, whether those are financial system or climate disasters or geopolitical things. There's a lot of reasons that a lot of people can see to be more self-reliant. But as I say, different things motivate people in these spaces and, some people are very powerfully motivated by the positive. I can live a better life now. I've got a secret formula that people don't realise, that you don't actually need to earn as much money, you know, that I can get my clothes from the op shop and I can do things and live well on a fraction of the income that others do. So those sort of motivations are also very strong, along with the serious concern about what society will be facing in the near future.
I want to go to Jodie Lane. She lives down in Margaret River, embracing the permaculture life. And the story starts, though, on those forest blockades. Cast your mind back to the 1990s, to WA's beautiful southwest, and that big fight over old growth. Jodie, what were those days like for you?
They were exciting. They were very full of community. A lot of people getting together in response to environmental loss. There was a lot of sadness. It was a huge mix of emotions as people tried to come to terms. And they still are. I have to say it's an ongoing fight. It's not something that happened back then. Our forests are still under threat. But the sense of common purpose and how we could approach this was very important. And I suppose permaculture for us was very much a positive response as people fought against the horrible stuff that was happening in the forest, to actually then come and plant trees and do something positive towards the future was very important, and to have the two in balance was a big part of it for me. And I suppose that's where I continued on the permaculture lines.
Where did the permaculture... You had this first permaculture garden. Where was that?
My first permaculture garden was actually in Northbridge. I got hold of David Holmgren's book when I was a uni student and started there. I always dreamt of having more space to garden with, in 1986 my parents bought the property that we currently live on, and it was just a bit of a dream come true, really, to go and expand and grow more and get animals into the system and work with other people and really start to see how much food we could produce.
Now, the land sustains... Now, this is in Margaret River. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Jodie Lane. She is a permaculture practitioner of Fair Harvest and four generations of your family, the Lanes. And where does the story start? They bought it in 86 and now?
Yeah, well, look, they bought it mainly because they fell in love with the block of bush that was in the centre that the real estate agent very cleverly sort of didn't show them because he didn't see it as being valuable.
Right.
But having that beautiful central bush was something that they saw that they wanted to protect, and from there on started to plant trees, and I think they've planted over 30,000 trees on the property. I followed them down in 91 and then really moved in 95, which was when those forest blockades days were happening. Moved in with a group of people who I suppose it was a bit of a safe house at the time. It was let's go and fight the forests and fight for the forest, sorry, and come back and have somewhere to stop. Permaculture was the was our guidelines. It was the way that we approached our lives and started to design gardens, orchards.
It set out the roadmap.
Yeah, animal systems. It really started back then.
And now the family, you've all got different roles contributing on this big lot of land down there in Margaret River. Tell me about that.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, Mum and Dad are... Everybody's growing food. Everybody's growing food and involved in different ways. But being involved in the community is a very big part of it. And I would see them as our leaders in community and involvement. Dad being on the council and Mum being in all sorts of groups of people. But Margaret River is a very active area for permaculture, and there's groups of people who are not just looking at gardening. They're looking at how we're going to manage transport, how we're going to manage water, how we're going to design our very growing town.
Massively expanding, isn't it?
Yeah, and as David was saying, you know, it does encompass all of these areas. I think people like to think of permaculture as gardening, and it's fantastic listening to your listeners and how much food they're growing in their yards. And I was up in Perth a couple of weeks ago and walking around the suburbs, seeing how many more people are doing this was really exciting and really inspiring. So, yes, a big part of permaculture is about that food growing, but it's also about the broader design. And I don't think any of us can pretend that there's not big changes that we're facing at the moment. And so the response to that is very important, and it's at a community level that's happening.
Now, at the start of the show, I played a little bit of this.
Gotta plant a tree, then plant another 3,000. Now's the time to start feeding my soul.
And that's how Charlie McGee fits in. Charlie McGee, let's bring you in. What is Formidable Vegetable Sound System?
Well, that's too many syllables for me, actually. I've dropped the sound system.
Oh, I mean, you did.
Who needs a band name with 10 syllables, really?
just Formidable Vegetable.
Formidable Vegetable it is these days, and we are, as far as I know, the only permaculture electro swing funk band in the world.
How much demand is there for this sort of work?
Surprisingly a lot. I have been touring
too much.
Yeah, as David says, I've been touring non-stop for the last 7 years, and I say non-stop, the longest I've been in one place for is 10 days. So... you just kind of think about that. You know, this is a very different kind of permaculture I'm doing. I'm more interested in the culture side of permaculture, the actual embedding of the principles and ethics in our collective consciousness. Because, you know, while being at home and growing your own food and connecting to your community is essential, I think also there needs to be this sort of top-down approach where we need to start disseminating this information into the mainstream media and into mainstream education and into music and the arts, which is what we do. So basically, I'm a thinly veiled permaculture propaganda machine that gets the principles out there through songs.
Well, they're pretty catchy. We've been dancing around in our office, and I've got one coming up for everyone before the news at 11 o'clock. How would you describe one of his shows for those of us who haven't seen one?
Well, so... Before I started this project, a friend of mine and I were watching some permaculture presentations at a festival over East, and we were just riveted by the content, but the presentation was just appalling. And I remember we were just sitting there, and she was just turning to me and elbowing me, going, "Hey, this is really interesting, but let's make it really fun." And I thought, that's a brilliant idea. You know, it took me a while to come around to the idea of writing songs about permaculture because, let's face it, I mean, as a concept, it kind of makes you want to cringe. And my favorite quote from David was when I first introduced him to my songs, he sent me some feedback which included the quote, "I didn't cringe once." So I really hope that, you know, one of our shows is something that's super fun, super dancey. We've got lots of funky electronic beats and ukuleles and trumpets and trombones and things. So it's kind of like a party, but there's a serious message underneath. And I really think that the role of music and the arts needs to start coming back to that function of a practical message or a practical piece of learning, because traditionally throughout, you know, ancient indigenous societies and cultures have always used music and the arts for this purpose, and it's only in our culture that we've kind of just used it as this marketing tool, you know, for selling stuff that you don't need. So, you know, on a deeper level, that's what we're trying to do. But we want to keep it really fun, make it like a rock concert. Permaculture is a festival. Farmers are rock stars. You know, get amongst it.
I love it. For us city dwellers, escaping the city to live off, I suppose, the fat of the land, that's how it is. But for you, it was the other way around. What was life like for the young Charlie McGee?
Well, yeah, so I had a pretty unique upbringing for where I was, which is was in Pemberton in the southwest, WA.
Beautiful and, spot.
It is a beautiful spot. But, yeah, like Jody was mentioning, you know, I witnessed the, you know, the threat to the old-growth forest, and my parents had a very ecological outlook. You know, we were unfortunately in a minority at that point because most of the town was sort of in the timber industry.
Can imagine.
But it gave me a good perspective, and the fact that my dad was implementing permaculture principles at home, you know, through our compost toilet and our veggie garden and our chickens. You know, we didn't have power, I didn't have TV, I just watched my chickens, basically. You know, coming to the city was like almost a foreign country to me. So I didn't really have a concept of this other world, which most people just accept as normal. And so for me, you know, that's been a great experiment in trying to bring these experiences to the world and say, hey, look, this is how I grew up. It's totally possible. It's totally great. And it's really not that much of an inconvenience. In fact, you might enjoy it.
Do you think that's the appeal of your music?
Why don't we hear a song that embodies that?
I can tell
Charlie
a story. If you want a live song, I've got my ukulele here. It probably sums it up.
Do it. Come on then. Come on.
Right.
We've got some of your other music in a moment.
This is about growing up. So when I was a little boy, I liked to catch the rain, while people all around my town watched it flow right down the drain. But because our little shed in the bush wasn't on the mains, the only water we had to use was in a tank caught from the rain. 'Cause there's no such thing as waste. This is where the permaculture comes in. Only stuff in the wrong place. Hey, it even rhymes, check it out. No, there's no such thing as waste. Yeah, misusing water's a disgrace. Then I moved to the city, rented a house on my way to buy a bed. But I saw one lying on the side of the road, so I took that one instead. And I also found a fridge, a couch, and a big old sewing machine in the biggest pile of thrown out stuff that I had ever seen. But there's no such thing as waste, only stuff in the wrong place. No, there's no such thing as waste, only opportunity to be embraced. So there you go.
Charlie McGee from the Formidable Vegetable Band, an impromptu performance there on ukulele. I'm so impressed. Why don't we listen to another one of your songs? My big thanks today to David Holgram, one of the founding fathers of permaculture. Charlie McGee, musician from now the Formidable Vegetable. They changed their name from Formidable Vegetable Sound System. And Jody Lane, who joined us from Margaret River, where there's four generations of her family down there on the land, practicing and embracing permaculture. Here you go. Here's a bit of Formidable Vegetable.
Family food bowl, stand my ground but give up control. Know the boundaries but tear down all the walls. Won't give up or give in to apathy. Gotta plant a tree then plant another 3,000. Now's the time to start feeding my soul, feeding the soil, believing anything is possible.